This Week in Radio Tech is supported by Bill Meeks at Meeks Mixed Media, maximizing brands large and small in the new media space. On the web at meeksmixedmedia.com. Also by Violet Microphones, handcrafted in Latvia for generations. On the web at violetusa.com. And by Telos Systems. Telos Audio and Networks, the best way to hear from there. On the web at telos-systems.com.
And now, our feature presentation.
Twert.
Right, we took the center conductor and the bullet out, so we just had a copper tube that went from one size down to the other. Vacuum hose fit right into it.
All right, calm down. He says that to everyone.
This calls for immediate discussion.
What's up,
Dad? Yeah, all your data belong to us.
From his palatial office of important business.
Or in a choice hotel in a distant land.
This is Kirk Harnack.
It's a War Stories episode with Brigadier General Tom Ray and Colonel Chris Tarr. Ten Hut.
You're dialed in to This Week in Radio Tech.
It's time for This Week in Radio Tech. Hello, I'm Kirk Harnack, and I'm really glad you could join us. We're going to have a fun show tonight. It's not about serious stuff. It's not about learning about modulation and electrons and AMs and FMs. It's War Stories. It's the favorite kind of episode that we have. We get a lot of feedback on these episodes. But every 10 episodes, we gather some engineers together and we talk about life in the trenches, some of the funny or not so funny things that have happened to us while we're doing our jobs as broadcast engineers. And we try to figure out something to take away from that in terms of learning. Book learning, on-the-job learning, OJT, OJL. So let's introduce our co-host, and we'll reverse the order and bring in from Milwaukee, Wisconsin, a guy who's in the trenches, Mr. Chris Tarr. Hello, Chris.
Hello there, Kirk. How are you today?
Man, I'm great. Tell me about you, though.
I am the Director of Engineering for Intercom's radio stations in Milwaukee and Madison. I also have an online website forum for engineers called the Virtual Engineer at broadcastengineering.info.
Broadcastengineering.info. All right, check it out. We'll have in the show notes. Don't check it out during the show, though. Check it out after the show. And joining us from the Hudson Valley in New York, it's Tom Ray. Hi, Tom.
Hey, Kirk. Good evening. How you doing?
I'm great. And what's up with you? Tell us about Tom Ray this evening.
Well, I'm the Vice President, Corporate Director of Engineering of Buckley Broadcasting, and I'm headquartered at WOR Radio in New York City, the 50-kilowatt flamethrower here on the East Coast, and I'm just ready to rock and or roll.
The 50-kilowatt flamethrower at 710 WOR. How many towers you got there, Tom? Is it three?
We have three towers, and at some point we'll probably have to discuss AM antenna systems because ours is kind of unique.
Oh, really? Okay.
Well, right. Because of all the filtering and stuff we have for the other stations that are around us. And actually, Chris Tobin, who's not with us tonight, actually would be very interesting to talk to because we took a tour with the SBE chapter of the WCBS and WFAN transmitter site last week. And if I'm not mistaken, they're the only non-directional in the country that is combined into the same tower. So you walk into the tuning house, and man, you've got 100 kilowatts flying all around you. It's kind of neat. And all my fillings have been reset, so I'm all set to go.
I've got a great picture. I guess we should bring show and tell pictures one episode here, even though we're primarily an audio podcast. I've got a great picture of a fellow named Warren Schultz. He's the engineer for WLS in Chicago, and he's walking into the transmitter room, and he's holding the Jesus stick, the stick that if you don't use it, you will meet Jesus.
Yes.
Some of our listeners will appreciate this. You know, station monitor at the WLS doghouse. This is the room that has the tuning assembly and feeds directly into the tower. The station monitor consists of a couple alligator clips with a diode hooked between them, and that feeds into an audio amp, some old. I don't know if it's a guitar amp or what, but that's all you need.
And you know, something tells me it's really broadband.
It's really broadband. Yeah. Well, it picks up WLS just fine.
So do my fillings, though, for that matter.
Hey, let's talk about a few things. Tom has a rant he's going to get to shortly, but look at what I have to show you. Now, I know. Yeah. I know regular viewers of the Twit Network are looking at this and going, yeah, So, but I think this thing's kind of cool. It's an iPad. I got one on, of course, the first day, and my intention has always been to use it for real engineering type stuff. But I was been playing with a few of the applications here, and there's this kind of cool application which is a VNC client, so I can dial right into my server here at the house that I have my Magic Jack phone line, and I play some audio for the benefit of a Telo Zephyr IP demo. So that's a VNC client. We can just from anywhere, anywhere I got some inner tubes, you can run right on that. The of course, all the swiping is kind of neat. Let's see, to turn this thing off, you swipe it like this with three fingers and it turns off.
Have you found it really handy and useful yet, or have you really found some uses for it?
All right, here's the first war story of the evening. I've got a rubber pad on it here. Let me take it out and just this. Here's the iPad itself. Okay,
an iPad pad is what you're saying.
Yeah,
and you've already put it in the rubber room.
So one of the best applications so far has been going to YouTube. It's the YouTube application. And I found out we were babysitting my grandson and found out that my grandson absolutely loves Yogi Bear. So we did some Yogi Bear. Now, here's a little video. This is from the Twit Cottage. Obviously, the thing plays video, so I'm not showing anybody anything they don't already know with that. But yeah, the first application that got some good use was playing Yogi Bear cartoons for the grandson. It just keeps him entertained for hours, which brings us to the relationship to This Week in Radio Tech. I'd like to hear if anybody knows of good radio engineering applications for this. Are there references? Are there online things that maybe are not just browser-based? Has anybody written apps for an iPad that help you do maintenance or keep track?
I could give you a list from just on my iPhone. I had a bunch of different applications for engineering. They have RF calculators, antenna calculators. Okay. All that kind of stuff.
Do you have some app names handy? Can I make a note of a couple?
I'll send them to you, yeah.
Okay. So watch the show notes, and or maybe during maybe while Tom's talking, we can get Chris to look up a few of these apps. Sorry to spring this on you guys, but hey, this thing's really cool. I do like it. And it's funny that there's two camps of people, seems to be. There seems to be people saying, why would I ever really want or use that? I mean, and pads have been tried before. Slate-type computers have been tried before, and well, no, Apple hasn't done one. I mean, there's been some Microsoft ones that I thought were actually kind of hard to use myself. So, it's easy to use, and it's easy to carry the thing into the restroom if you want to read the paper while you're in there. It's easy to take to bed, watch a little movie. We were watching a Netflix movie last night. I was just too lazy to get up and go in the other room and watch the Netflix movie on the big TV. So, we watched a few minutes of the ending of the movie Heist. But I would like to relate this back to, I think that you're going to see a lot of medical apps for these things. This probably will show up in the enterprise for medical practices because it's tough, durable, reliable. The batteries last all day. But how will this get used for broadcast engineers? And
I was just looking at in the chat room here on the IRC, and somebody mentioned talking about looking at the transmitter readings. And as a matter of fact, I did that with my iPhone. I've got VNC running on a computer that runs Autopilot, made by Burk for their ARC 16 system. And just looking at my iPad or iPhone, you can log in and see all the transmitter readings and turn the transmitter on and off and search patterns and all that kind of stuff right from that screen.
Sure, that's a good idea. In fact, that reminds me, I've got to find the link, but I already have on this thing a... I'll have to find that while we're while somebody else is talking. But I've got a link in here to get me to an Omnia audio processor that's at one of my radio stations in Mississippi. So I'll have to look that up. But I can adjust the audio processing from here. Of course, we're just using a browser to do that. And hey, a browser, I mean, how useful is that? It can be very, very useful. But I suspect that some enterprising engineer programmers are going to come up with some applications for the iPad. Back in the day when I was doing full-time broadcast engineering, I would have loved to have a program that helped me keep up with maintenance and when air filters have been changed and, you know, how many hours the tube has on it. You know, right. I still do some engineering and I write all these things down in log books at different transmitter sites. But wouldn't it be nice to have those in a convenient, easy place? So if people in the Chris, I'll count on you to keep watching the chat room and see if anybody has any good ideas along there. We got a rant from Mr. Tom Ray as part of our War Stories episode. So, Tom, understand you bought a new car. Tell us about that.
Yes, I did. I had a company Ford Explorer that had almost 230,000 miles on it. And very frankly, I told the Ford dealership they should take the rear wheel bearings out of that vehicle and have them bronze. They were originals. But it finally needed a whole bunch of back end work, and it just, at 230,000 miles, it wasn't worth doing anything anymore. So I stopped at my local Ford dealership, because I'm a Ford kind of guy, and I bought myself a brand new Ford Escape, a 2010 Ford Escape. And, you know, we sat around and we talked about the various things I'd need. No, I didn't want the four-cylinder engine. I wanted a real one. okay. You know, the type of tires, the fact that it had to have four-wheel drive, and then we argued over price, and you know, we did the credit check and all that stuff, and I bought the extended warranty because it's going to be a high mileage vehicle. And then I asked the ultimate question, and I actually, it wasn't a question, it was more like, okay, now I would like to get a factory HD radio installed in this thing. And the sales girl looked at me like I was speaking a foreign language and pointed to the Sirius sign. She says, but it comes with a Sirius. And I said, I didn't say I wanted Sirius. I said I wanted HD radio in the car. Yeah. Well, we got the parts manager, we got the general manager, we got the business manager, and we all sat around and I educated them about what HD radio was, and they got Ford on the phone. It doesn't exist.
Really?
It does not exist. Not really.
But
maybe
that,
next
but I
year.
Know Ford's involved with HD radio. I sat in the Ford.
Yes, they are. Yes. But you cannot get one right now.
Really? Okay. So they're gearing
have
up
to put an aftermarket in the car, which is okay. But here's my point to this whole thing. You know, WOR in New York City, the first high power full time AM HD radio station in the country, has been on the air transmitting an HD radio signal since 2002. In 2007, I believe it was, maybe it was 2006. I forget the year. We were allowed to turn it on 24/7. Okay. You have a whole bunch of HD radio stations now on FM that are running in HD2. Some are running in HD3. There's one in Washington, D.C. running in HD4. And yet, you know, if I walked into the BMW dealership and bought a BMW, I could probably get an HD radio in one of those vehicles. I could probably walk into, Mercedes dealership and buy a Mercedes with an HD radio.
Okay.
I didn't want one of those cars. I needed something that could. I needed a real vehicle that could actually get some work done. And you know, if I walk around my neighborhood, I see Ford, I see Chevy, I see Honda, I see Toyota. I don't see Mercedes. I don't see BMW. I don't see any of the other high-end cars that supposedly you can get HD radio in right now. And boy, I got to tell you, if we're going to have this take off or be accepted by the public, you've got to be able to get it. I found a great kit at Crutchfield. I bought a brand new, and I haven't gotten it yet because they're out of stock, because Kenwood tells me that they can't keep up with the demand for them right now. But I bought a Kenwood HD radio, which does not have the outboard HD tuner. It's all built in.
Okay.
And Crutchfield has a nice little kit that, because I'm going to have to replace the trim panel on the dashboard where the radio is, but they also have a kit that interfaces with the sync system in the car, which is what interfaces to the telephone and everything else. So I had to buy that, and I had to buy the radio. I'm going to have to take the dashboard apart to put this in. How many consumers are going to do that?
Yeah.
Especially my age. You know, I mean, come on, you know. You do that when you're a teenager. You do that when you're in your 20s. You don't do it when you're my age.
The last time I put a custom radio in my car, in fact, I paid somebody else to do it. And here I am, an engineer, fully capable of getting that done. And I said, you know, I don't want to do all that. I had to put a 2-meter amateur radio rig in there, 2-meter 440, and an HD radio in the car where the big honking Toyota 4Runner radio used to be. So I know what you're talking about. I didn't want to do it myself.
Yeah, and you know, bottom line is, if this is going to do something, I mean, it's been, we've had it on the air 8 years now. We've had it on, you know, it's been legal for us to have it on 24/7 for at least 3, if not 4 years already. When does the public get to have this, and when are we? You don't expect over with a new technology, you don't expect overnight acceptance. But right. You know, that iPad came out, Kirk. You bought one right away, didn't you?
Yep.
And you probably had some reasons, but you found a use for it.
Yeah, I
can't reasons. Get my hands on the radio. How can I find a use for it?
Yeah. All right.
So, but that's my rant.
So if you could change something about that situation, what would you tell Ubiquiti, and what would you tell Ford, and what would you tell Chevy and other automakers that are real popular in the U.S. among, you know, the average working folks like us? What would you say?
First thing I tell Ubiquiti would be that, look, guys, you really got to drop the high-end stuff. Not that that's not important, but you need to get this into the hand of Joe average consumer. And you need to get it into the Ford, the Chevy, the Toyota, the Honda, the Hyundai. You know, the car manufacturers. I mean, we've got iPod docks in the cars. We've got, they're talking next year coming out with IP connections for the cars.
Sure.
So that should scare the hell out of broadcasters, because that's going to open up the person's environment in the car to the world. We have CD players in the cars, you know.
Here's the thing about that, though, is that the satellite radio guys spiff the manufacturers and the salespeople with these radios. Meanwhile, HD radio, not only do they don't have a program like that, but the chipset is more expensive. So, you know, there is really a good push and an incentive to put satellite radio into cars. With HD radio, it's kind of a hopefully the chicken and the egg thing, where they're going to create the demand for this. So,
on the chipset, you can go to crutchfield.com. You can buy an HD for the dashboard of your car for $99. So,
right. But then, you know, then again, you look at what, you know, even a stock, but a stock radio is $50 at Crutchfield and $300 if you get it through Ford.
Right. Oh, no, exactly. And you know, there's going to be a markup no matter what you do, but you're right. You know, if the satellite radio guys are going to spiff the dealerships, I don't have the answer to that, because, you know, I can't see the station spiffing the dealerships, and I just don't know what the answer is. But the bottom line is, if this is going to get accepted, it's got to get in the cars.
You know, it seems like each kind of each business model, each technology has its own challenges. The challenge for the satellite radio guys is, yeah, they do spiff the car sales or the car company, and they do give 6 months or a year of free service, and then they want you to sign up again. And I've even heard some horror stories of satellite radios in cars. I would consider this a horror story, where if you didn't re-up for the satellite subscription, that once it ran out, that it audibly bothers you, even if you're listening to AM or FM or CD, that the radio audibly bothers you, telling you to resubscribe to XM or Sirius. Now, I'm sure people in the chat room people might correct that story and get me exactly right on the details later on, but that was the gist of the story. How do you get the radio to shut up, to quit reminding you to do this? Yeah, disconnect it, pull it out. Somebody supposedly had a link to a website that told you where to drill a hole in the case to cut a trace to get the radio to stop talking at you. So other people have had this situation too. So the problem for the satellite guys is is getting people to pay the money and subscribe and getting them to re-up. I think the churn rate is pretty high. In other words, they don't get many people, as many as they'd like, certainly, re-upping once their free period runs out. So that's a problem for the satellite guys. The problem for the free-to-air HD guys, the broadcasters who are doing this, is to get people to pay the money for a radio anyway that may be hard to get. You got to educate the salespeople you're talking to about it, and then you got to pay to install it and maybe mess up your dash or change the highly integrated radio that's in there. Tom, I'm surprised and quite pleased that you found a radio that will integrate with the Ford Sync system, which is very, very cool. Certainly on this network, Leo Laporte talks about how cool it is in his Mustang.
Yeah, so it is a very cool system. I mean, there's nothing I've gotten real used to it in the last week. Driving down the road, you hit a button on the steering wheel, and you just go, phone, call Kirk Harnack, and it dials, and you're there. And we talk, and it's great. So yeah, it is cool, but it's actually, it's not the radio itself. There's a special interface kit that Crutchfield sells that does the interface. But we mentioned Sirius and stuff before. I'll fess up. I've got an XM account. The car's got a built-in Sirius radio. I called the XM up and said, look, you're the same company. I said, can I transfer my XM account to Sirius? Nope, not allowed. So I'm going to have to figure out what to do about that too. But I'll let you know, and I'll take some pictures as I put the thing in as we do perform surgery on a brand new car. So.
Well, I see that. And by the way, on that XM Sirius thing, that's interesting. It seems as though not giving you a convenient choice, your choices now are to cancel XM and not re-up with anybody, or to cancel XM and then sign up with Sirius. Are those your choices?
This signing up with Sirius isn't going to happen. I don't like the sound of their codec. And I've also noticed that driving under bridges around here, I'm not talking getting stuck under the bridge. I'm talking just driving under the bridge. XM doesn't drop out. Sirius glitches. So I thought that was rather interesting. But I did find that there is an XM radio that is out of stock right now. But as soon as it comes in, it will talk to the Kenwood. And it'll integrate with the steering wheel controls. And it's for XM, but most of the ones out there for the cars are for Sirius.
Gotcha. Well, here we've been going 20 minutes, and it's a War Stories episode, so, you know, we better get to a war story. And I know that Chris Tarr has been thinking about a couple of war stories. So, Chris, I'd like you to take it away and kind of set it up for us and tell us something that happened and what you learned from it.
Sure. Well, this was several years ago. I had a Harris FM 2.5K transmitter. And, you know, it would go off the air, it'd go on the air, it'd go off the air. You know, never really could trace down exactly what was going on, because as quickly as the problem would occur, it would clear up. So it was getting kind of frustrating trying to nail this down. Well, eventually the transmitter came down and it wasn't coming back up. And went through it, was just pulling my hair out. Well, it turns out that there was something going on with the IPA. I don't remember the tubes that those transmitters had for the IPA, but it was pretty low power. I believe it was 45 watts out of the IPA. And it was the first time I really sat down and thought about it. I looked, and the exciter for this transmitter was a BE FX50. And I got to thinking, well, really, you know, the IPA at this point is pretty useless. There's no reason we couldn't just take 50 watts out of the exciter and put it right into the transmitter. So with a little futzing around, I found out the relay that had the interlock for the IPA bypassed the IPA, shut it down, cut power to it, connected the exciter directly to the transmitter, turned it back on, and away it went. And I think for me, that was kind of the first time that I really, because it was early in my career where I went, you know, sometimes things are designed the way they were because at the time, that's all they could do. You look back at those transmitters, they came with 15-watt exciters. So really, that was pretty normal, and 45 watts, you kind of go, well, why bother having an IPA for 45 watts? Well, they didn't have 50-watt exciters back then.
You know, come think of it, that transmitter, that FM 2.5, that used the IPA was a little tube, and I want to say it was like a 4X150. It wasn't even a CX. It was a 4X150. Yeah.
Real, real odd one. And, you know, we just kept having problems with that IPA failing. And, you know, I kept saying, well, you know, I can't think of any good reason to not bypass it at that point. And, you know, but I, being a young guy, I'm like, well, you know, I it'll blow up or something. You know, and it was just really, it was just, it was designed that way because at the time that's what worked, and bypassed that IPA, and it worked fine ever since. And we just left the 50 watt exciter on there, which is solid state and obviously a lot more reliable than the tube type IPA. But in fact, I've actually heard of people with the 20K, which is the 20 kilowatt version, that also has kind of a flaky IPA section, where they took a power amplifier and an outboard power amplifier and used that instead. So it's kind of thinking outside the box and being creative. And, you know, in my case, I probably just didn't know enough to know better and went, oh, this will work. And it turned out to be pretty good and in the long term paid off.
You know, if you really understand what's going on in the transmitter, it's funny. I really ran across exactly the same thing as you, Chris, with a Harris FM 2.5K and some trouble with the IPA tube. And I think the trouble was not that the IPA, the intermediate power amplifier, was troublesome. It's that the tube died and the owner of the station wouldn't buy another one or didn't have another one. And we had to get something going. And it turned out that I was a contract engineer at the time, and I had access to an exciter that would put out about 50 watts. And I remember thinking the same exact thought process that you did. Will this work? Is there something special about the interface between this IPA tube and this Harris and the PA tube, the power amplifier tube? And it turned out that the interface between the two was approximately 50 ohms in characteristic impedance.
Exactly. Yeah.
So, yeah, you could substitute an amplifier that was putting out at 50 watts or so and about 50 ohms, and voila, you could make this work. Now, there are plenty of other transmitter designs, FM designs, that have an IPA that were not 50 ohms characteristic impedance between stages. So I'm thinking of some transmitters made by CCA, for example, that used like a 5CX1500 tube or maybe a 3CX800 tube as the IPA. And the impedance between the output of that and the input to the power amplifier, there was no breaking that open unless you totally redesigned the circuit, which is, you know, I wasn't qualified to do by any means. Right now, I'm you know, part owner of a station in Mississippi, a couple of them, and we've had a transmitter that's been a little bit troublesome. Indeed, the exciter keeps blowing, and so and a couple times the IPA has gone out as well. So we've substituted now a 250-watt capable exciter, where the exciter and the IPA used to be, and just run the tube with the output of a Crown translator type transmitter. It's all back now, but there have been plenty of occasions where we've substituted that. So, Chris, what I'm curious, you know, there are a lot of engineers that have gone through the same kind of process. Will this work? What don't I know about what I'm about to do? Will this blow up in my face? Will I fry what I'm about to hook up, or do I really know enough about this to make it work? Have you dealt with those moments in your broadcast engineering career? Things you didn't know, were a little afraid of, but just might work.
Oh, heck, I just cranked it up and went. That's where you have your mentors, your friends, your network of people. And, you know, there have been plenty of times when I've called a guy and said, am I insane in thinking this, you know, and in this particular situation? That's what I did. I mean, you know, I kind of ran it very low to start out with, and it looked like it was going to work. And so I called somebody who had, you know, trusted pretty well and said, listen, what do you think? You think this is going to work? Am I stupid in thinking this? And, you know, he said, no, it should work. There's really no reason. And we went, you know, talked about the impedance of the thing and said, yeah, I don't see any reason why that wouldn't work. Go for it. So just start out really low and just very slowly work the power up, and did it very slowly and gradually and made sure there wasn't any ill effects. So, you know, very rarely would I just jump in and do something like that. But, you know, I'll get the idea in my head. And, you know, I always call that, you know, I got to call the guy who's smarter than me on this one and, you know, just kind of go, what do you think? You know, is that going to make sense? Does that make sense to you? And, you know, usually if I get something affirmative, or I'll get, you know what, I don't know, but it doesn't sound like it's going to be anything that's going to, you know, kill anything if you try it. You know, so I've had some of those too, where you look at it, it's a low voltage thing, or it's, you know, it's nothing critical, where you go, ah, you know what, worst case is I, you know, blow a resistor or something. I have no problem. And I'll just try it just to try. And that's how we learn.
So have you ever tried something like that and had a complete disaster where you, you know, smoke, fire, the circuit breaker
trips?
Yeah,
there has been. There have been one or two of those.
And this is why he keeps marshmallows and weenies in the car.
Yeah, there was a transmitter we had that had a variable power supply, and I, you know, that the rheostat for it burned up, and I went, you know what, we only need 5 volts or whatever, so, you know, we'll just bypass it. And yeah, I was completely wrong. You know, I don't remember exactly what we did, but, you know, I did all the wiring bypass and hooked up something external to it, turned it on, and it just smoked.
Oh,
I went, okay. Oh. I was wrong. But again, I mean, you know, some of those, it's going to happen, and that's how you learn. And, you know, I now know, okay, I don't want to do that again. So it was kind of embarrassing and a little frustrating, but it was a good learning experience for sure.
You know, sometimes we're trying to fix a transmitter, and especially when we're dealing with high voltages, a lot of times we would deal with that with an FM transmitter where you had a power amplifier tube. And, you know, when you have high voltage attracts dust. and you've got air being forced through these circuits, these cavities, to keep things cool. And so there's a lot that can go wrong over time. A lot of, you know, dust and bugs and nastiness can build up, and those things are all unfriendly to high voltage. So I know there's been times when I've had to deal with a power amplifier tube circuit, and maybe the Teflon or the Kapton would arc over, right? A lot of transmitter designs. Yeah, a lot of transmitter designs. You know where I'm going with this. A lot of transmitter designs will use a material like a sheet of Teflon that's wrapped and squeezed between two tubes. Imagine taking a metal tube. This is actually a chimney, and wrapping some Teflon around it, and having a slightly larger tube outside of that one, and they squeeze together. And what you have here is a capacitor between the inner and the outer sections of the air chimney, and the inner part of this is energized with the B plus, or the high voltage that touches the tube, and the outer part of this is at DC ground, but it's not at RF ground. And in doing all this, you end up making a circuit that the tube is operating at high voltage. We extract the RF energy from the circulating tube circuit in the quarter wave cavity, typically. And we're still connecting all of this to the outside through an air duct, so we can get rid of all the heat from the fins of the tube as we blow air through it. So, you know, this Teflon can arc over. And some companies use, I think Harris uses a material called Kapton, and it's quite effective too. But you know what? You can't buy sheets of Teflon or sheets of Kapton down at the local Five and Dime or the Ace Hardware. So you don't always have a spare quantity on hand if this stuff arcs over. So I know that I have used less Teflon than I should have, and just kept the voltage low. So let's say that part of your Teflon is torn up. You don't have any more Teflon. So you take some scissors, you cut the sheet, you rewrap it, you put the thing back together, and you think, okay, I've got about half the thickness of Teflon that I used to have here. First of all, the capacitance will be a bit different. But second of all, the high voltage handling capability, the arc over threshold of this capacitor I've made, is going to be different. It's going to be less than it was before. So let's run the transmitter at low power until we get some Teflon in here. So you guys done stuff like that?
Here's a great story about transmitters, you know, that have those sorts of problems. My first week here at Intercom, I had just moved here and, you know, was getting my feet wet, and one of our transmitter sites, main transmitter, went down. So I get the phone call. Okay, great. You know, I have my cheat sheet. I'm going to turn the backup transmitter on. That lasts about 30 seconds. It goes down. We have an auxiliary site. Turn that on. It was fine. So I drive up there. Now, you know, to the defense of those radio stations, they didn't have an engineer for a while, you know, in the time that the last guy left and I got here. So, you know, they were just kind of on by the grace of God or whatever. So I get out there, and the main transmitter was simple. That just had a clogged air filter. So I replaced the air filter, turned that back on, and it was time to look at the backup transmitter. You know, what's going on here? And this was an old 20H3, Harris 20H3.
Uh-huh.
And I turn it on, it'd go up to 20 kilowatts, and then almost immediately fall back to zero and shut off. Okay, so I open up the back, and the first thing I notice is the high voltage lines coming from the power supply. Not only did all the vinyl around them are gone in ash on the floor, but it had been that way so long that the copper had turned green from oxidation.
Oh.
So that was problem number one. Problem number two was the PA tube was bad, and not only was the PA tube bad, but also the socket was loose. So this was literally turned into a several hour project, you know, kind of, you know, making things work, you know, electrical tape around the copper for now, and getting the, you know, replacing the tube and tightening up the tube socket and everything and putting it all back together. But you know, you're mentioning the Kapton, and, you know, all of that stuff, you know, just collects dust like crazy. So it was really, you know, taking the thing apart, cleaning it out, making it shiny again, putting it all back together. You know, after all that, the transmitter ran great. But it's just amazing how quickly, because they did a, you know, real good job of maintaining that site. But just, you know, over time, with you know, not a lot of maintenance going on, that transmitter just kind of became unhappy. And that's what happens is they work fine for a while, then they sit, and you turn them on, and that inrush comes in, and it just starts making things unhappy.
Tom, you had a high voltage story, I think. You're about to tell us.
Actually, I was going to mention I do have a good a good story for you, but I just wanted to mention you were talking about the Kapton and at AM frequencies, those little capacitances that make a big difference in FM and are kind of irrelevant in AM.
Yeah,
and we had an old 317C1 transmitter at it's Continental over at WMR.
Continental,
at
the old facility. Now, is that a big Doherty type 50 kilowatt?
Oh yeah. With the two 4CX35000s in the final cage, and we had an issue. Every now and then, this thing would just, we'd have it on the air for testing, and it would just, no rhyme or reason, just pop a plate breaker. And finally, one day, I just said, we got to find out what's going on with this. So we started taking things apart very slowly, and they had a piece of Kapton under the way the socket's designed, the screen contacts for the tube come out to a metal plate, and it does form somewhat of a capacitor. And we found that there must have been some, whenever this was changed the last time, God knows when, there must have been a little piece of crud on the metal deck underneath, which finally worked its way through the Kapton and popped the hole. So it was arcing over.
Yeah.
And of course, when the screen arced over, that would draw excess plate current, which would pop the breaker. So we needed to have a backup transmitter, and we didn't have a piece of Kapton, so we looked around and we found a piece of rubber gasket, and we put it in there, and
it worked, huh?
Now if you tried that with FM, it wouldn't have worked because you would have had a problem with the capacitance. But with the AM,
it would have been all wrong.
It was such a little difference. It didn't care. The transmitter didn't care. It just sat there and ran. It was fat, dumb, and happy. But
You're right. That kind of goes back to our fundamental series about AM and FM and some of the behavioral differences. At AM frequencies, we can be sloppy about a lot of things that are occurring at radio frequency, at RF, at about 1 megahertz, middle of the AM dial. But at 100 times that, at 100 megahertz or middle of the FM dial,
Those little things make a big difference.
Much more important. Yeah.
Yeah, they do make a big difference. But the story I was going to tell you, when I was a little pup of an engineer many moons ago, station I worked at, this FM, we had as a backup transmitter, we had a Harris 7.5B. So that's a 7,500-watt transmitter, and I'm going to say it must have dated back to the early 60s. And the way this transmitter was designed, it had two cabinets, and one cabinet was, it had this whole big cabinet for a 4CX250 tube for 250
yes.
watts out.
Yes.
Oh, God. And then the other side was the 7,500-watt power amp.
Uh-huh.
So my boss says one night, he says, come on, we got to go up to the transmitter. I forget what we were doing to the main, but we had to pull the main apart. And he says, let's go up. So we put the 7.5B on the air. And it's sitting there. It's running at 7,500 watts, having a great old time with itself. And we start pulling the main transmitter apart, and we get the thing to the point of no return, and all of a sudden the phone rings. And it's the DJ on the air, and he says, we're off the air. We're off the air. And, of course, we had a radio up there, and as anybody who's worked with FM before knows, there's enough leakage through the exciter and through the transmission line going into the transmitter that it'll drive the radio. The radio, you'll never know you're off the air.
Right, so especially with FM, when the radio is the same volume no matter what the signal strength is.
Right, exactly.
You really don't have an idea of how much signal you're picking up.
And you're listening to blower motors and stuff in the room, so even if it gets a little noisy, you're not going to hear it.
Yeah.
So I turn around, and sure as heck, the transmitter's down. And I notice there's a blown plate fuse on the IPA on the 4CX250 side.
Yeah.
These were the kind of fuses, they'd spit a little thing out the end, and you'd see the little red thing in the little plastic fuse holder.
It had an indicator, a flag. Yeah.
Yep, exactly. And I walked around the back of the transmitter and popped the back off and just kind of scratched my head, because now we're off the air. And I take a look, and I immediately realized what the problem was, because I noted that when I pulled the back off the transmitter, there's this little squirrel cage blower that blew into the 4CX250. It wasn't moving.
Oh.
So I tried to move that, and oh, my God, the bearings were just locked up tighter than a drum. It's like, oh, boy, now what? So my boss is looking at me. I'm looking at him. Excuse me. Can't put the main transmitter on the air. And, we had about an hour's work to get it back on the air, and we're saying, now what? And I looked over in the corner, and I noticed the vacuum cleaner. And then for some reason, and I don't know why, we had a 7/8 inch to 1 5/8 transmission line reducer sitting there.
Oh, no. Do I know where this is going?
So I pull the squirrel cage blower off, and I take this reducer, and I put it. I take that back. It was a 7/8 to 3-inch. Why we had 3-inch, I don't know. We didn't have 3-inch line. I lined it up, and two of the holes lined up. So,
oh my gosh! Yes, so the squirrel cage blower probably had what, either a round or a square output on it, and it had like four bolt holes around it. Yeah,
exactly what it had. So we had a roll of duct tape, put duct tape around the holes, put the output of the vacuum cleaner on it, turned it on, replaced the tube, brought the transmitter back on, and finished the work on the main.
did you see the movie Apollo 13?
Yes, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, and when the guys assemble all the stuff, they have to assemble in the hoses and some duct tape and try to make a working environmental system. That kind of sounds like what you had to do there.
And don't forget, you only need two tools in life, WD-40 and duct tape. If it moves and it's not supposed to, you use the duct tape. If it doesn't move and it's supposed to, you use the WD-40.
Yeah.
You're done.
and you just have a hammer for encouragement. There you go.
No, I use that for tuning.
So you use this adapter reducer. This was a brass thing normally intended for connecting different size coaxial cables together, right?
Right, right. And we took the center conductor and the bullet out, so we just had a copper tube that went from one size down to the other. The other side, conveniently, the vacuum hose fit right into it.
Oh my!
So,
gosh.
I mean, it couldn't have gotten any better than that. It was. We took a picture. I have never found the picture. But I went up the next day to replace the squirrel cage blower, and I remember taking a picture of it. We had it on the transmitter room wall down in the AM station because it was the funniest thing.
I'm sorry if I missed this little detail, but did you have the vacuum cleaner on suck or blow?
Well, we used the blow side, and let me
tell
you,
blow side. Okay,
while we were off the air, it sucked.
Oh my gosh. We've talked on the show now about a couple of Harris transmitters, and you know, Harris transmitters sometimes get the brunt of jokes or stories because there's so many of them out there. And I swear, when FM stations went on the air across this country, a lot of them in the 70s and maybe a few in the early 80s, but a lot of them in the late 60s, early 70s, and throughout the 70s, there were a lot of Harris transmitters sold. The 2.5 kilowatt size, the 5 kilowatt, the 10 kilowatt size, and the 20 kilowatt sizes. And a lot of these transmitters, unfortunately, I just retired one a couple of years ago in Mississippi. There's nothing salvageable from it. We ended up shoving it out the door. It laid out in front of our transmitter site for 2 years, and it just a month ago, somebody took it. It's gone.
I've got a BE story, although it's not really particular to BE, but I was one night changing a tube in my BE transmitter, 30T. And so I get the old tube out, I get the new one in and get it seated, get everything put back together again. And I turn it on and the thing's doing like 10% power. What the? So I start tuning it, you know, adjusting the tuning and raising the power. And, you know, everything's looking good. There are no, you know, there aren't any kind of error light, you know, no fault lights or anything. And I'm getting like 25% power and I'm starting to swear at it. I'm getting really angry. I'm like, what the, you know, come on, you little, you know, I was just getting really frustrated. All of a sudden, my assistant taps me on the shoulder and kind of, you know, slides me over a little bit, over and flips the plate breaker back on.
Oh,
that would help.
the way the breakers are, the BE transmitters, they're along the side next to the cavity, starting from the floor going up. And I must have, while I was changing the tube out, my knee must have hit the plate breaker. And, you know, it's not the real hard to swap, you know, the real hard breakers. These are just the ones that kind of flip up and down. Yeah. And I must have flipped it. I was sitting there swearing at it. I was yelling. I was getting all mad that this piece of junk transmitter wasn't working. And he walked up, didn't say a word, just walked over, flip, and then turned the transmitter on.
I'm surprised you're getting 10 or 20 or 25% power out of the thing without any plate voltage.
Well, that's the thing is, you know, I never really thought of it because it was making some power. I'm like, Jesus, thing won't tune up. What's going on? Another one along those lines was with an Autel, an AM transmitter that I put in Milwaukee. And, you know, they ship the transmitter to me, and it's a fairly light transmitter. It's a 6 kilowatt. It's about the size of a refrigerator. So we get it, you know, up and we get it all put together, and I get the power hooked up, and it's all ready to go. I'm like, okay, I'm going to hit the button and turn it on. Turn it on. Front panel looks like about a kilowatt. And it's supposed to be running about 5,400 watts. Mm-hmm. Okay, so I turn the, you know, look at the power. It's set for 5 kilowatts. It's not doing anything. I'm ripping out the manual. I'm flipping through it. And we couldn't figure it out. It turns out, after looking around, that in somehow in shipping, and I had sent a picture to Natal, they're changing, they changed the way they ship these, the copper strap that fed the output of the PA to where the socket is for where the plumbing comes in, the antenna plumbing comes in, there's a copper strap, and the strap actually came disconnected from the PA. So when I turn it on, it actually wasn't loading into anything. There's just a strap hanging back there that had kind of broken off. So we had to drill a new hole, put it all back together. And you know, so that was another one that I was like, this transmitter fucked up, you know, and after, you know, really looking into it, there's actually something else going on there.
It, that's funny. I've had the same thing happen, and I think I caught it before it, you know, it bit me with no power. But yeah, I had on the same transmitter, undid the hardware to put the coax in and hook it up to the, you know, to the outside world. And that same piece of little copper strap came loose, and I realized, oh, that's not hooked up. So I had to undo everything again and hook it back up again. So yeah,
it was like a Mythbusters moment. I'm looking at it going, well, that's your problem right there. And yeah, we just, you know, ended up drilling a little hole in it and remounting it. And I called over to Nautel and they're like, absolutely, you know, get a picture of that so that we can see, you know, if there's maybe something we can do in shipping, you know, to prevent that from happening. But it sidetracked me for about a half an hour trying to figure out why my transmitter, brand new transmitter, wasn't working.
Oh, how about the other reason why Nautel transmitters don't work out of the box? You ready?
Go ahead.
Well, Nautel does a wonderful job of protecting the large meters on the front of the transmitter. At least this was true with some previous transmitters that I had bought and installed. And they protect them by installing a shorting clip between the terminals on the back of the meter. You know, this is the big kind of, you know, meter that looks like this, right? Mm-hmm. So if you don't realize that these shorting clips are there, you'll turn the transmitter on and the transmitter may actually be putting out some power, but the meters are all reading zero or very close to zero because they're shorted.
Well, when I started tuning up the new WR site, got the transmitter set up, and on the 3DX50, you've got a power meter, an analog power meter, but you've got the LCD display. So I, you know, hit the low power button, and I start hitting the raise button, you know, bop, 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 to start ramping it up, and I'm taking a look. Power meter's not moving, but on the LCD display, it's telling me I've got a kilowatt out. I'm sorry, I've got a kilowatt coming back and nothing going out.
Hmm.
That's interesting. I look up at the dummy load, and I've got an ammeter on the dummy load, and it's sitting there doing 4.5 amps. It's like, well, obviously it's going out.
That's a kilowatt.
Yeah, but even if I had, if there was something disconnected between the transmitter and the dummy load, I'd still see about a kilowatt going out and a kilowatt coming back if I had reflected power. I'm like, that doesn't make any sense. Then I kind of scratched my head and shut the thing down and opened it up and found that there's a, for alignment of the directional coupler, there is a test switch on there. They accidentally left it in the test mode. And when you do that, it swaps reflected and forward.
And this part
in the right position.
This lets you set the trip point for the VSWR so you can actually feed it a little bit of power, make it think it's coming back into it when in fact it's not.
Right, and you know, it worked a whole lot better when I put it in the right position. So.
That's right. So think about this. I've run across a couple of transmitters, the same brand, same model, I think, in totally different cities that had the same odd repair done to them. Now, see if you have an experience like this. This is a Harris transmitter of 1970s, early 80s vintage. So this would be like a 5H3 or a 10H3 transmitter. This is the one where this is an FM transmitter, and it's got the PA cavity is right about eye level, right? And it's got the little, what do you call those, quarter-turn D-Zeus connectors, those D-Zeus fasteners? Yeah. And so you could take all those off and take the back of the cavity off. Well, think about this. Where's the blower in that transmitter? It's on the floor.
Right.
Right?
And you've got a sock that comes up.
What connects the output of the blower to the bottom of the tube cavity? It's this big piece of canvas, this canvas tube that goes from the output of the blower to the input of the tube cavity. And it's what, about 3 feet long?
This canvas tube? Yep.
Yeah, about 3 feet long. Well, you know, after years of vibrating and air going through this canvas tube, the places where it connects, at the top and bottom kind of wear out the canvas, you know, like having keys in your jeans pocket. Eventually you kind of get a little worn spot there where your keys stay or where your wallet stays or where your can of Skol stays. Okay. So when this thing wears out and you can no longer keep it connected to the blower and the bottom of the tube cavity, what are you going to replace it with? Well, you could call Harris and order the proper piece of canvas. But what if you're off the air? What do you do?
You could use a piece of canvas. You could use a piece of cloth. You could use you could get some duct tape out and get real creative.
Hey, you could do that. But I'll tell you what apparently two engineers have done. Weren't me, but here's what two different engineers. Hey, maybe it's the same engineer, and I was just following his footsteps. This engineer takes off his Levi's.
Oh, jeez.
Takes a pair of scissors to one leg.
Oh, no.
Cuts off a leg of his Levi's. It fits perfectly. Now, I don't think these are the straight leg Levi's, you know, the boot fit. I think these might be I guess they are straight, the straight ones, or maybe a slight flare. Okay. Not every style is probably going to fit both ends. So
I want I want to congratulate Kevin H on the IRC chat. He actually guessed the jeans pant leg before you did.
Yeah.
And the other thing I wanted to mention is only you would bring up the Skol, you know, thing in your jeans, the can of chew. Yeah. Yeah, Nashville. That's Nashville for you.
Just a pinch between your cheek and gum. So,
which cheek?
Yeah. So the same repair at two different places. Now, hey, if this is the same engineer, maybe he's walking around in a pair of shorts right now. I don't know. But a pants leg. I've been to two transmitter sites with the same Harris transmitter. Pants leg between the blower and the input to the tube cavity. That is a creative repair.
Oh, that sure is. It sure is. But, you know, it was funny before you both mentioned BE transmitters. I had a BE transmitter. It was a 5B, 5 kilowatt. And I was about 35 miles away working on another transmitter one night, and I got the phone call from the station. We're off the air. And I went out to the car and turned it on. No, you're not. You're on the air. I'm hearing you. And they said, no, we're off the air. And they gave me the transmitter readings. They had plate voltage and nothing else. And I said, yeah, okay. So after I got through with what I was doing, I went to the transmitter site up there and walked in. And sure as heck, no plate current, no power output. Transmitter sitting there with plate voltage and just cranking away. So I shut it down and scratched my head and opened the back door and took a look and popped the tube out. And when I popped the tube out, I noticed this jagged line down the ceramic that between the anode and the screen ring. Oh, and I said,
crack, huh?
Yeah, it all the vacuum came out.
The vacuum and, came out.
You know, plugged a new tube in. It came right back up, did 5 kilowatts. But, I mean, I was impressed. 35 miles away, and I was able to hear that thing. And I don't think it was putting out more than 10 or 15 watts, if that much.
Sure.
Because there was nothing. I mean, the power meter didn't even come off the pin. It just sat there. So.
Wow. And the cracked ceramic, like you said, let all the vacuum out. So the inside of the tube must have been instantly contaminated with air. And so now
it's an arc. And the electrons couldn't move, and that was the end of it.
Yeah.
And the filaments probably burned up, you know.
Go ahead, Chris.
So I have one more for you with AM. I have a 5-tower AM array in Milwaukee. And all of a sudden, I started getting real weird readings on my antenna monitor saying that our antenna broadcast signal pattern was not correct. And, you know, the transmitter was happy. So that was kind of the first indication that maybe there's something, it's getting some bad data. But I went out with my antenna monitor and I verified that, yes, my antenna pattern, my signal pattern was accurate and it was in and it was legal and the way it's supposed to. So then you start looking at what's going on with, you know, with your antenna monitor. Now, for those of you who don't know, with AM, an antenna monitor is almost like a loop antenna up on your towers. And what it does is it measures the phase of the signal and the relative power on each of the towers to give you kind of a indicator on what your signal looks like. And it's kind of a numeric indicator with this meter. The long and the short of it is it has these loop antennas on the towers that they're called sample loops. And that's where you get your readings from. So, you know, I checked the sample lines. Those looked okay. Okay, next thing is we send the tower guy up. So I narrowed it down to what I thought was probably the tower that had the issue. So okay, I need you to go up and take a look at the sample loop, make sure it's not loose and not rocking around or anything. So he climbs up the tower, and I mean, literally 10 seconds in, found your problem. It was one of these old, it's the old design that has, it almost looks like the spark plug, looks like a spark plug where the coax comes in, and then it's got the insulator that looks like a spark plug, and then the copper that goes from the top over to the loop.
Okay.
Well, yep. Over time, water gotten in there and the connector went bad, and he literally, when he went to grab the connector, the whole thing just fell apart. It was just disintegrated in his hand. It's like, found it. Well, you know, here's the problem. You can't really find those parts anymore. And, you know, so the long story short is, as we were figuring all this out, we were able to fashion a new insulator and a new connector. But I'll tell you, it was kind of funny because you just, you know, those are the types of things you I wasn't expecting. You know, I figure, okay, maybe there's, you know, water in the connector. That happens a lot. But, you know, literally touches it and the whole thing just crumbles in his hand and falls apart. And so we ended up having to MacGyver something together. But again, just something you'd never imagine. And there it is.
Well, you know, Christy, that now that you mentioned that, that reminds me when we were starting to tune up the WR transmitter site, we were going to come in this one particular evening to fire the directional up at low power and to bring it up slowly and see what happened. And we came in and we started bringing it up and we had no indication coming back from the third tower. It's like, oh man. Okay. Well, but we verified that, you know, we only brought it up to 10 kilowatts and the impedance didn't look too bad. So, okay, fine. We went out, went to bed, came back the next day and started scratching our head. And we started doing some tests and said, oh, well, okay, it's got to be with the sample loop on the tower. It's got to be something to do with that. So we called the tower crew. They came down. They started rigging the tower to go up because I had a spare piece of sample line. They were going to change it out. And the consultant and I, we went to the output cabinet because all of our tuning components are in cabinets at our facility. And we went to pull the sample line out of the output box, and it wouldn't move. We could not move it. It took him and me on one side. It was like a tug of war. Him and me on one side and two big, strong tower guys on the other side to finally free this transmission line from passing through the bolt into the box. And what we determined was that the day we were going to come in that night to fire it up, we had a thunderstorm pass over. Tower must have got hit by lightning, and it arced through the sample line, and it welded itself inside this thing.
You know,
Go ahead,
Chris Tarr. Go ahead.
I was going to say, kind of the moral of this, I think is kind of interesting, as you mentioned this. You know, my first instinct when that happened, when I saw that the pattern was out, was to start cranking on the knobs on the phaser, and you want to bring it in. But my instinct kept telling me, you know, if it were as off as this antenna monitor is saying, you know, my transmitter wouldn't be happy. You know, I'm going to have to go with my gut on this. And although everything says the pattern's out and you need to fix it right away, my gut's telling me that's not the case, that I'm just getting some bad data here. And so I had to trust my instincts to not do anything rash and then just go out and, you know, with the field monitor and check it out. And it's the same thing as that. You know, your first instinct is to really just tear into things. And, you know, I think the lesson I learned from that is, you know, instead of assuming that something's broken, don't trust the data sometimes. And that's exactly what it was the metering, the instrumentation was incorrect, that everything was actually fine. It's just the data that I was getting was bad. And, you know, so instead of jumping the gun and making all these changes, take a look at what the meters that I'm looking at.
No, Chris, you're right, Chris. And what they do with directionals, or what people do with directionals, they want to get in, they want to start cranking, and then when they do, they don't remember to write anything down, like the turn indicators, and you can't go back to where you came from. So the best way to do it is you just slow down, take a breath, grab a pad, write things down, and then just start putting the things together logically. And usually you don't have to touch the phaser. And if you don't have to, that's always a good thing.
You know, that's probably one of the best takeaways we can get from this episode of This Week in Radio Tech is not just you can't always believe the instruments, but what you've got to analyze as an engineer is this problem a real problem or is this an indication problem? And if it's an indication problem, do I have some alternate ways of knowing that I am on the air, or I'm at the right frequency, or the power is correct, or I do or don't have reflected power, or there is or there isn't pressure, nitrogen pressure in the line, whatever it may be, is there some proxy? Is there some other way of knowing what it is that I'm trying to find out? AM directional systems are indeed some of the most complicated, and because so much of the system is out in the weather, and subject to, and some of it's underground too, or subject to, you know, getting eaten by a mole or something, or a backhoe. We have to be able to tell whether the problem is real or not real, whether the problem is just one of indication or one of actual transmission. And this is one of the keys about being an engineer and learning to discern whether the problem is real or not real, and whether the problem has something to do with the indications you're being given or not. You know, I think a great example of this that a lot of our listening audience and viewing audience can relate to is when you have a problem with your computer and maybe a Microsoft troubleshooter pops up on your screen. Oh, I see you're having a problem with this or that. You know, it seems to me like 99 times out of 100, my problem has nothing to do with what the troubleshooter pop-up thought it was. It's something different.
Yep.
And only, you know, computer, only experience and understanding of what the computer wants to do or is trying to do will tell you that. Same thing with engineering. Only a real look at what's going on and using proxies, that is other indications for what you're trying to measure to help you figure out what's really wrong and not just what on the surface appears to be wrong. Would that be a good takeaway?
I think that would
absolutely
be.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Well, good. My work here is done then. Hey, guys, we're at the end of our hour of war stories. And by the way, did you notice that our war stories episode, and it really wasn't planned. I mean, we didn't, you know, talk about our stories to begin with. But, you know, none of us have a war story about a CD player. It's always about a transmitter.
Well, the ones about the CD players are boring, you know. Who cares about those?
Remind me next time we do this. I've got a couple of good ones for you.
All right. Well, CD player war stories?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my gosh. Okay. All right. Well, I'll remind you next time. Okay. Episode 40. Hey, we got to sign it off. Thanks very much for joining us, everyone. If you want to get this episode or any other episodes of This Week in Radio Tech, you can subscribe to them at the iTunes store. Just search for TWRT, This Week in Radio Tech, and subscribe to the podcast. We have an RSS feed button available on the website at thisweekinradiotech.com. And, of course, you can always catch us live here on the TWIT network at live.twit.tv. Many thanks to Burke for switching the show tonight and to the other members of the cast of the TWIT Network, TWIT Cottage, for taking care of us so well. That's it for This Week in Radio Tech. We will see you next week.
That's all the bandwidth we can pilfer this week. Another TWRT has propagated, and all the transmitters and audio equipment live happily ever after, thanks to the handsome engineer and his kind, benevolent care. We'll be back next week.
Lord willing, and the creek don't rise.
This Week in Radio Tech.
Subscribe to iTunes and you'll never miss a show. Search for This Week in Radio Tech in the iTunes store. Soliciting is strictly encouraged. If you like today's show, tell a friend. If you didn't like it, we were never here. Kirk Harnack's wardrobe provided by the Salvation Army and the Red Cross Disaster Relief Services. Hair and makeup provided by Penny LePay Garcia Hernandez Weinberg.
He's unique, wouldn't you say?
I just want to get it over with.
This ends this transmission.
Tango, Whiskey, India, Romeo, Tango.
Signing off. Okay.